Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. A report warns of an increase in the number of children being recruited as child soldiers in Africa. We'll hear from a former child soldier who was forced to pick up arms and fight in northern Uganda.
It was a harsh environment to live in. Children were made to do horrible things that would make them fear coming back home. May you fear you might also be killed, knowing that you participated in doing something wrong. So will my family, will my community accept me and receive me back?
And why inclusive conversations with local communities are important in conserving rhinos. It's Wednesday, February 19th. First, to matters concerning the US and Africa. The suspension of USAID funding has sent shockwaves around the world and poses an unprecedented challenge for the international aid community, particularly in Africa. With millions losing access to life-saving aid and tens of thousands losing employment, this further compounds the challenges that Africa's most vulnerable communities have to contend with. Amongst those most sharply affected are people who rely on the USA's PEPFAR program for the supply of life-saving HIV drugs. Some patients now lack access to the drugs and essential services. In South Africa, scientists have halted trials for a promising HIV vaccine as a result of the funding cuts. Governments are now looking for other ways to plug these funding deficits. For example, Kulimani City Council in central Mozambique has increased taxes to raise alternative finances. Teniola Tayo is an economic policy advisor focusing on trade, security, and development issues. And she began by telling me about the effect of the aid freeze.
Teniola, thank you for your time. What's been the immediate fallout of the US suspending funding to USAID in Africa from where you sit?
The most immediate fallout has been the loss of jobs, because as we know, the USAID was an employer of Africans within the continent. But also there were many other firms or development agencies that were dependent on the USAID that have now laid off African workers or followed them. So you have the job losses, first of all. And of course, second of all, is the loss of funding to some critical healthcare projects that were being run by the USAID and its affiliates within the continent. And the third one effect, of course, is going to be on developments, because the USAID was a big partner with some development projects or programs, such as, for example, Prosper Africa. So it's really three stages, most immediate being job losses, the second being the financing for things like healthcare and humanitarian response, but also the long-run effects that it can have on development. And what I can say here also is that some countries were more dependent on USAID funding than others. So you have countries like Ethiopia, the DRC, which is even currently going through a conflict. You have some other vulnerable countries, you know, like even Liberia, and USAID funding made a bigger part of their own development assistance. And there's some analysis that says that it can even affect their GNI, leading to a drop of up to 3%. So that's going to be quite a shock to their economies.
Could you remind us what a GNI is and what it's used to measure?
GNI, gross national income, it just means that a lot of the funding coming into the country, some of the funding coming into the country was coming through development assistance.
What would African governments need to do now to try and plug those deficits? And I imagine their plans would be dependent on just how much they were getting through this program.
It's sort of a nuanced conversation, because some governments were more reliant on USAID than others, and some governments are more reliant on development financing or development funding in general than others. And one of the statistics that is often thrown out there is the fact that for some countries, diaspora remittances are even higher than what is received as development funding or development financing. So the picture looks different depending on the African country that you're looking at. But some of the steps that obviously have to be taken is to, first of all, to analyze and to figure out which parts of the country's affairs will be most affected by these funding cuts. I'd like to take a step back here to say that even though now we're talking about the USAID, there's been a trend of a general reduction in development funding over the last couple of years. And it's some analysis that I even did last year. So even from the EU perspective, from other funding partners such as Germany, from the UK, generally there's been a reduction in funding, because they were putting more funds towards, for example, the war in Europe between Ukraine and Russia. So it's a trend that has been on the horizon for a while. And of course, we know that African countries, a lot of them are facing fiscal issues. So they're able to generate a lot of revenue domestically to meet their development needs, also because we are facing high population growth. And it's why some countries are taking debt, some of them finding themselves in default positions. But there are resources to be mobilized domestically, whether it's from the private sector. And then we need to figure out the best ways to go about that, to begin to plug in the gaps and begin to preemptively address some of these things rather than then trying to respond to them as an emergency situation.
Taniela, some people wonder if this is a rude awakening for African governments, ministers of finance, for example, because you talked about domestic resources that could be used. It almost signals like there's been a lot of potential, whether you're looking at utilizing what's already there, raising new taxes, fighting corruption, freeing up all that money that could be used to fund some of these programs that were being funded by aid programs, whether from the US or other countries. What do you think about that? Just how much potential is there within the resources that countries have?
There is a lot of potential, but in terms of the question about whether it's a rude awakening, I think seeing the issue with the USAID happen with such speed may have been shocking to some governments. But then the writing has been on the wall for a while now. And African governments themselves have been pushing this narrative of moving from aid to investment, of pushing from aid to trade. So they themselves have been going to conferences and saying that we don't want your aid. We want you to do business. We want you to invest. We want to do trade. So I would say that it shouldn't be an unexpected development if we look at it from that perspective. And if countries are now more interested in investing or doing trade with African countries, then the question is, how have we positioned ourselves to be able to reap the benefits of that and to reap value from those kinds of engagements with our international partners? And to your question about, you know, how much value can be unlocked domestically, again, it's sort of like a chicken and egg situation, because in order to unlock value from African economies, there needs to be some investments in these economies, because at the end of the day, you can only generate things like taxes when there's sufficient economic activity to do so. Because what we can't do is to place an unfair tax burden, to increase the tax burden on African citizens that are already struggling with things like the higher cost of living. For example, in some countries, there's inflationary pressures. In some other countries, there's even currency pressures and people are really struggling. So that is not an option. But then the option to generate more value from the economy is going to be contingent on whether African countries are making the right kinds of investments into these economies and make sure that the firms, as one example, the larger firms, the medium-sized firms, are able to generate value that can then be, to an extent, captured and then allocated towards widespread development.
Taniela, do you think the areas where USAID was directly funding, for example, the HIV programs, could they be sort of dressed up as investment opportunities and not areas that need free money?
It's a tricky question because, you know, there are different models for this around the world. If you look to the US, healthcare is very commercialized in the US. So everything is really about generating cash. And that's why healthcare is so expensive here. But then there are some other more, let's say, more admirable models in Europe and in Asia, in fact, where people are not having to pay so much for access to health or access to critical drugs. And there is a lot of government support for these things. The extent to which African governments can take on the responsibility of supporting things like, for example, subsidizing HIV treatments is an important one to explore, because, again, they have different capacities and they face different constraints. But I do think that there's room for engagement with African private sector. So now, not necessarily from the commercial side of things in terms of just making people pay through their noses for drugs, but even from, let's say, a balance between philanthropy and then, of course, commerce. Some firms already within the continent, I can give, for example, the Dangote Foundation, are already looking to play in the healthcare space. And I think that there may be, there's a bunch of others that can be engaged by governments to help fill in the gaps. And the thing about these firms is that they are homegrown, they are local, so they have more skin in the game. And they are actually sometimes even committed to seeing better or improved health outcomes on the continent.
And are we likely to see other foreign powers perhaps stepping in to plug the gap that the US is leaving behind?
What I would really not you know, be a fan of is if, you know, African governments are just hoping that, you know, some of these other partners simply just step in to fill in the gaps, maybe even looking at other fellow developing nations to step in to fill in the gaps. You know, that's not what we should be working towards. Now it's really about laying the foundations for making sure that next time when something like this happens, everyone is not talking about what Africa is going to do. That's not the kinds of conversations that we should be having about ourselves.
So in terms of then laying down economic policies that can reduce the reliance on foreign assistance, what are some of the things that need to be worked on and how does that foundation need to look like?
First of all, the fact that we're not generating enough resources domestically. And second is that the resources that we are generating, one could say that they're not being spent in the most ideal way or in the most efficient or effective way. So these are two aspects of the same problem. So yeah, first of all, get better at spending what we do generate. And then, of course, start to lay down the groundwork for even generating more resources domestically. Some countries have tried to create diaspora funds to get the diaspora more involved in development activity, really. And I think that we probably need to put even more attention on that because the size of diaspora is growing and it's going to have to be an asset that we leverage and mobilize more strategically going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Economic Policy Advisor, Teniola Tayo. In the past 5 years, around 21,000 children in Africa have been recruited by force into armed groups, and that's according to the Institute for Security Studies. They said that in 2020, 118 million children in Africa lived close to conflict zones, with one in six of them at risk of being recruited. In 2021, a UN report revealed that West and Central Africa had the highest rates of child soldier recruitment between 2016 and 2020. While eradicating the problem of recruitment is proving to be ambitious, there are opportunities to strengthen ongoing efforts to try and reduce the frequency at which these children are recruited. There are also efforts to address, for example, the root causes of conflict, enhancing monitoring and reporting mechanisms, educating armed groups about legal responsibilities, and building resilient communities, all necessary actions to combat child soldier recruitment. But there are challenges too when former child soldiers return to their families. Those who are lucky to come back face stigma and struggle to fit back into their communities. My colleague Audrey Brown has been speaking to a former child soldier in Uganda, Wilfred Komakech, who is now a program director for the Grassroots Reconciliation Group, which helps others rebuild their lives and find acceptance back into society. Let's listen.
I was under abduction for a total of 1.5 years, so definitely I'm a former child soldier.
The reason why I'm asking is because when you say that a child was a soldier, it implies in a way that the child was complicit or agreed to being in that role. So you said that you were abducted. And I've heard people in places like Liberia and Sierra Leone, for instance, saying that we don't talk about child soldiers, we talk about children associated with wars, as in children that were forced into the position that they found themselves. What do you say about that?
That depends on the context, because much as I might have not joined voluntarily, but was abducted, but definitely the processes I went through, I think definitely qualifies me to be a child soldier, although not a voluntary act.
So what processes did you go through that turned you into a child soldier?
Different trainings I received when I was under abduction. And also, I was made to go to different places to look for food, also participate in abduction of other children as well. So those are some of the things, the military training and the different trainings that you're given under captivity.
Do you feel that you were guilty? You know, do you take responsibility for having done them, even though you were abducted?
There is some sense of responsibility, but also it's difficult. It's somehow blood because, for example, when we were under captivity, I was below the age of 18. I was given command and instruction on what to do, and failure to do that might have me either killed or severely punished. So whatever I did when I was under abduction was because my commander instructed me to do so. So basically, much as I felt the guilt of participating in doing a number of those wrong things, but also at the same time, I was forced. And that is the context here when there was war in northern Uganda.
Were there people that you knew that refused to do them and got punished?
Definitely, yes. Of course, among the many people that were abducted, if you failed, for example, to obey orders, you are severely beaten. Or at times, there were even those that were killed. You are instructed to do this, and failure to do that, you choose the other harsh option of being killed.
Did that scare you, the idea that you could be killed or severely punished if you didn't do what you were told?
Definitely. Of course, that is one of the worst things that I live with, the trauma of sometime even to have participated in obeying such commands, because it was against my conscience. I knew it was wrong, but because of my commander's instruction, I had to participate.
When you think back to that time now, what is the thing that makes you most uncomfortable? What makes you, you know, stop in your tracks and takes you back to that place?
The lost opportunities that many child soldiers have missed while they were under abduction, and also for the different things they participated in doing while under abduction, and they live with the guilt and the trauma to date for some who managed to come back, and they're struggling to regain their psychosocial well-being is not in shape. So that is what our organization is trying to do, to provide psychosocial support so that they can fit in the community.
Is it difficult for you to remember being back there at that time as a child, being forced to do things? The first time you were abducted was the age of 10 in 1996, and you were held for 6 months. And then you escaped, but you were abducted 4 years later.
It's not difficult to remember because, for example, in 1996, that was the year I was supposed to sit for my national examination. But because I was abducted, I missed the opportunity to sit for a national examination. So I would vividly remember the wasted time, 6 months under abduction. And when I came back, there was another year. So I remember everything that happened.
And you think of it with sorrow, with sadness, because it was a lost opportunity, because you were going to pass and move on, right?
Yes, that was the feeling in my heart, because I missed the opportunity. I was sorrowful because I was no longer with my family. I do not know what was happening in their lives, and I missed fellow children going to school and participating among my peers. So I'm living under fear and intimidation. So it was a harsh environment to live in.
What was the most difficult thing to do when you finally escaped the clutches of Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army?
And the first difficulties was making the decision that you will be accepted when you come back from the abduction. Because children were made to do horrible things that would make them fear coming back home. So that was one of the things. Would I be accepted by the communities when I come out and tell the people that I'm coming from the Lord's Resistance Army? You fear you might also be killed. So that was the greatest fear. And also being accepted into the community, knowing that you participated in doing something wrong. So will my family, will my community accept me and receive me back as a child? That was the hardest decision I think I made.
How did they accept you when you came back?
After coming back, I was taken to the local LC1 chairperson, and my information was taken. They took me to a military barracks. From there, I was introduced to a World Vision Reception Center in Gulu, where I underwent some rehabilitation.
So there was no hostility towards you, no stigma attached to you. Did people forgive you and allow you to heal?
The beauty is there was also many programs that were encouraging people under abduction to come back so that they may have reconciled and have amnesty. So because of that, the leadership accepted me because it was a totally different community I've never been to, and they helped me through. But of course, we live through this stigma that some people who still point at you that you are a former child soldier. Those who went and like children and came back with other children through rape and all that, those children are not accepted in the communities. So there are different kind of challenges that we still face in the post-conflict war in northern Uganda.
Have you ever met somebody that you wronged during that time when you were forced into being a child soldier?
No, I have never had that experience because once abducted from one region, you almost walk through the entire sub-region. Or at times also, you are made to cross to another country, that is South Sudan now. And I was also young during that day, but I remember those locations where I participated, for example, in looting and all those other activities. But I do not remember the people.
So you are part now of an organization, the Grassroots Reconciliation Group, that rehabilitates former child soldiers. Can you tell us about some of the children that you've helped to work through the trauma of having been forced to do horrible things and are now working more or less as successful human beings?
Through Grassroots Reconciliation Group, we help former child soldiers and the victims of the war to reconcile. So we have different programs that we provide to our targeted beneficiaries. And the first one is providing psychosocial and mental health support.
I was looking more at people rather than the projects and the programs. If there's somebody that you think, you know, had been through a horrendous time and has come out on the other side.
There are a number of them that we have supported, and they have turned out to be productive. And nowadays, even among others, some are community leaders, and they have overcome stigma, and they do not have any fear anymore because of the different trainings. And they are more productive. They are not now self-reliant. They can now take their children to school. And they are helping others, those that we recruited to be peer counselors and peace ambassadors. They are acting as mentors in their communities. So there are a number of them.
So what message would you give to other children who were forced into working for armed groups or being associated with armed groups for doing terrible things under the threat of armed commanders, armed groups, who might be struggling to find their place in society now? And I'm thinking of there are so many children from so many parts of the continent that are in this position.
Today, I use my experience to help others who suffered from similar trauma. And also my work in supporting former child soldiers, survivors and communities affected by conflict here in northern Uganda through reconciliation, livelihood programs have helped me a lot. I see that as a story of resilience and survival. So I want people to know that even in the face of unimaginable situation like a hardship that I have gone through, it's possible to rebuild and find purpose and also make a contribution to your community. It's a journey that inspires others to believe in the power of healing, education, and even community support.
Is it more difficult to get rehabilitated the older you get?
Depending on the stage of intervention, when you started receiving rehabilitation support. So when a person is younger, it's even would be much better. But also, it's possible to even receive full rehabilitation when we are positive about it. A person can still recover.
Wilfred Komakech, former child soldier in Uganda, speaking to Audrey Brown. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Conservation efforts to save the rhino across the continent have led to an overall increase in the number of rhinos in recent years, but the continent's rapidly growing human population and the consequent loss of ecosystems, experts say, will require new and more inclusive approaches to protecting the iconic animals. A new IUCN, that's the International Union for Conservation of Nature, report outlines a critical new approach for rhino conservation in the future, one that seeks to balance the needs of the animals, the growing human population, and the ecosystems and biodiversity that support them both. I've been speaking to Dr. David Balfour, the chair of the African Rhino Specialist Group, who's representing the IUCN.
Increasingly in Africa, we're finding that people who live around protected areas have grievances or concerns, and they're voicing these. They're expressing very clearly that they would like to be better consulted about decisions that are made and to participate in decision making in ways that has value to them. And we see this as being something that can contribute, obviously, both to improve their livelihoods, but also from a rhino conservation point of view, if the protected area is working more effectively and in an integrated partnership manner with people who live in the surrounding landscapes, then it's a much stronger, more integrated, better effort that is being put forward to conserve rhinos.
You talked about, you know, this kind of consideration not being there, maybe going back about 50 years ago. Why was that the case?
You know, I think we as a continent are constantly evolving. 50 years ago was very shortly post-colonial period for many countries. For some countries, it still wasn't post that period. So the way the societies were functioning was different. And I think what we're experiencing at the moment is the tail end of many of those processes and the ability of communities living around protected areas to more clearly assert their interests and what they would argue are their rights is a function of the change that's taken place over time. You know, that's a much bigger political, historical context that you're talking to, but I think we need to recognize that and work in that context to do these things better.
I'm wondering, Dr. Balfour, if there is an appreciation within local communities for rhinos, just in the same way you would say tourists, for example, or even conservationists are so fascinated by them.
If I give you a case study, I was recently helping one government develop a strategy, and that included a very intense consultation with peoples living around sites with rhinos. And what was so fascinating about it was the views of people who live in relatively subsistence lifestyles. They shared more or less the same views. They loved the idea of their children seeing rhinos. They loved the idea of being able to access their spiritual connection with rhinos. They loved the idea that there may be opportunities to engage in business linked to the fact that there are rhinos there. So I think the value that you talk about is a pretty broadly shared set of human values, may get expressed differently in different contexts, but fundamentally very, very similar.
And what about the angle of human wildlife conflict that we so, you know, we report about it so often? Is this a case when it comes to conservation of rhinos? Are you seeing that? And are you working around that as well?
What's interesting about rhinos is they distinctly different from, for example, elephants or lions when it comes to human-wildlife conflict. You don't hear stories of rhinos breaking out of these areas and damaging people's crops or being a threat to individual persons' livelihoods. So the conflict doesn't happen at that level, but there are stories, and I think it persists in some areas, sadly, where the enforcement of the law and the security teams who work at these sites end up being what local communities see as a source of conflict. So they can get rough. They need to arrest people. There's often security interventions that are not pleasant. So that conflict is, I think, real in many sites. And we need to look at that more carefully and find ways of reducing it, because I think that's where the future lies, is doing this in a much more contemporary, sensitive, human way.
Doctor, give us a good idea of some of the best rhino conservation methods that have been used in the past, what now you've picked and you're sort of building on that in this new framework that we are talking about.
I think it's really important here to emphasize that quite a lot of the approaches and techniques that have been developed over the last 40, 50 years remain very important and current. So the way we are able to capture and move rhinos between sites has enabled us, for example, in Zambia, where the rhino population was completely driven extinct in the 1980s, the larger conservation community have been able to reestablish a population of rhinos in Zambia. Similarly, in Mozambique, a number of populations have been reestablished. So that kind of technology at a veterinary level, very, very important. What's new about this is us as a community grappling with how we embed ourselves more effectively and better in the larger landscape and how we get it to work in a way that's win-win for people and conservation, particularly of rhinos.
And how hopeful are you that these suggestions you are putting forward will be implemented?
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, to be in conservation, I think, means you're an optimist. I certainly am hopeful. I see a lot of growth taking place in this arena, and I think there's really good chances. But it does require continuously challenging ourselves to do things better and to do things in a way that work better in the world that is changing. There are going to be a lot more people in Africa in the next 50 years, as I'm sure you're aware. That's going to mean less space. It's going to be greater trade-offs being made for resources that both people and conservation rhino need. And we need to engage in that discussion in a responsible way. And so we hope that will take place. I think it will. I don't see why not, but it's not easy.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Dr. David Balfour, Chair of the African Rhino Specialist Group. Focus on Africa was put together by Patricia Whitehorn, Nyasha Michelle, and Stefania Okereke in London. The senior journalist in charge was Connie Sharp, and the technical producer was Philip Bull. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Charles Gitonga. Thanks for listening.